Well, today is February the 26th, 2013, and I'm Steve Labruda on behalf of the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sport. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Francie Cracker Goodrich over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Now, Ms. Goodrich, Francie, where did you grow up? Where were you born, and where did you start out life?
I grew up and spent most of my life, certainly most of my training life as well, in Ann Arbor, Michigan. My father, Dr. Ralph Crocker, that's how it's pronounced, moved to Ann Arbor with my mother after he did an internship. He was a doctor, and they made their home in Ann Arbor. So that's where I grew up and was lucky enough to find myself as an athlete.
Beautiful. And speaking of that, when did you first start getting into athletics? And were you encouraged by your parents, or?
We were healthy young people. We didn't have school teams to look ahead to, but we had Michigan and our area in Ann Arbor was forward-looking in terms of recreational opportunities, and we belonged especially to, we loved to swim. We had lakes. We belonged to a swim club, and that's really where I got started doing more structured things as a younger person. I love to swim and dive and did a lot of that. But if anything, it might have been the lack of opportunity that we had initially that made me want to be an athlete even more. I grew up in, went to a Catholic school. My father was a major he was the head of their major fundraising effort when they built a beautiful new gym, and we weren't, as girls, allowed in the gym. So we were quite aware, even when I was very little in the 50s, that something was amiss. So I just did everything I could on my own. And once we got to junior high school, it was the same thing. I dearly wanted a letter sweater, but we couldn't get one except by being multi-talented, let's say, joining every club and organization, but we couldn't do it as an athlete when we were girls. So that was hard. And so when the first opportunity came along to do anything, I leapt into it, and that was to run in a junior high school play day, they call it, or field day. And so I happened to be very desirous of accomplishing something in that area, and when we ran 50-yard dashes, I beat everybody. Then we did President Kennedy's physical fitness test, which you might be aware of. It was pretty big in the 60s, right after it was instituted.
Yes, ma'am.
There were a variety of tests, but the main one that I excelled at was the 600-yard, what they called it, a run-walk.
Uh-huh.
So when we did this at our school, we didn't have a track. We just had a big field. And when we did it, I didn't walk at all. I ran, and I beat all the boys and all the girls in the school. And I had a physical education teacher, Betty Simmons, who said to me, "You're really a good runner." And that was the first I heard, you know, that kind of commendation. And the next thing I knew, she and her husband were asking me to train with them for the Olympics. I was 14, and I had no clue that that would entail.
So really?
That's where it started. That's where it started, and it was just out of the blue. And they sat down with my parents, and they discussed it, and I was really thrilled. I tell this story year after year that my mother, who never was an athlete, but she was, you know, healthy and wished she could have been, which so many women of her era would have been if they'd had the opportunity. She said to me, "You know, it's really important to be good at something, to be really good at something." And that got me started. I mean, I never looked back after that.
Wow.
So it was just opportunity out of the blue, and parents who knew nothing about athletics, no athletic opportunities were structured,
uh-huh.
And that's where it started. And interestingly enough, it was very similar in other pockets of the country where there would be a coach, somebody who recognized that girls and women didn't have opportunity and it was time to have it. And how this happened with Ken and Betty Simmons, actually Ken was known as Red, he was ultimately my coach, and my teacher was Betty, they went to the Rome Olympics as a vacation. He had been an old athlete himself, a fanatical competitor, and they went to watch the Olympics, and that's where Wilma Rudolph, of course, became famous. He was the only person I knew about as a woman runner. But there was an 800 meters for women, and the young woman, girl, really, that she was very young, probably 15, that was the only competitor for the United States in the 800 because there weren't any others who even qualified. She ran so poorly and was so it was so embarrassing to the U.S. that Ken and Red and Betty sat in the stands and said, "We can find a girl with talent and we can train her." And I was it. So that's how it started.
That is outstanding. Did you have any siblings or were you an only child?
No, I had one sister 14 months older and one sister 3 years younger, and we all kind of had our own talents and did our own things. So I was the middle one, and I was the one that sort of got picked to do this. So
that's outstanding. It's amazing how things start working, doesn't it?
Oh, well, in my era, it certainly was, because it never would have happened.
Yes, ma'am.
I never could have just said, I like to run, which I like to do. I ran around the block all the time with my neighbor kids, you know, that sort of thing. But I couldn't have said, I'd like to run on a team. There was no such thing.
Right.
So there was no avenue to do that. And yet, like Red and Betty Simmons in Ann Arbor, they started training me alone.
Right.
And then in other pockets of the country, there were other coaches very similar who were beginning to start what they called clubs. And the Amateur Athletic Union, or AAU, did have a club system. And the Police Athletic Leagues did some really good things in some of the big cities with young people and started to get young girls into the running realm, running and well into track and field, basically. So that was all really just getting started. There had been some, you know, well, let's put it this way, Tennessee State had a team, but they didn't have any other teams to compete against.
Right.
And that was the first of the college teams. So, you know, it was all happening in very small pockets around the country, but we still had a national championship to point towards, and women still went to the Olympic Games in that sport, in track and field, but just not as many of them because they weren't qualifying.
Amazing. So, what grade? You were in middle school at this time, still not
right. I was still eighth grade when I kind of got the impetus to start, and at the beginning of ninth grade is when I started training. Actually,
where did they train you, and what kind of regimens did they have?
Well, what was interesting was that my coach, Red, had retired as a police detective from the city of Detroit and started a second career. So he went back to school at the University of Michigan, earned a master's degree, and managed to get a job in the physical education department. So he was 53 when that started and when he started coaching me. So he had access to a point to some of the facilities at the University of Michigan, which were limited.
Sure.
There was one big field house, and he made friends with everybody. He was a beloved person. He just died last summer at the age of 102, so you can imagine the years, the decades that he had of, and he was just amazing. Well, in any case, he made friends with everybody, and they tolerated him letting me come into the track for a while anyway.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, it was just a dirt track in an old field house, and I'd run around dodging, and it was dodging because everybody used the field house, the men's teams, which is what Michigan had, only men's teams.
Yes, ma'am.
So in the fall, it would be football, and in transition, it would be basketball in the center, track, of course, baseball. Everybody would be in there. It was a melee. It was really amazing.
That is crazy.
Found out people. I'd be, as the football team would come in the door closest to their practice field, they'd come in huge numbers and huge guys marching across the track. I'd be running around, and they'd come across the entire field house, and I'd dodge around these guys. So I had to learn how to be very reliant, even at the age of 14. So it was amusing, but it didn't last very long. They didn't like me there, and finally they told my coach that I couldn't run there anymore, and So he had an old gym where the physical education program had their offices, and it was a beautiful old gym from the 19th century with a big with a balcony track, like you see even now in modern facilities. But it was basically two lanes. It had sort of curved in bank curves, and it was 10 laps to the mile. And he started me running up there, and not many people used it, and that was my training facility throughout the bad weather of Michigan. And I'd finally go to the outdoor track, which didn't pose as many problems. I'd use the Michigan track outdoors.
Wow.
The weather was nice. But it was interesting because nobody used that track. People weren't jogging and running in those days. And so I had it to myself, and down on the basketball courts, I'm trying to think there must have been at least four basketball courts down there. Intramural basketball would be going on all the time, all this noise and bouncing balls, and I'd run into people, men, who were playing down there long after I had finished running. Oh, I used to watch you run, because they'd be down there, you know.
Yes, ma'am.
There were generations of basketball players and just me pounding around the balcony, so...
That's
kind of how the training, how I was able to train, and my coach started me very carefully. I didn't run every day, and I still got terrible shin splints, and, you know, I really had to go through the physical transition, but he was really, he not only knew a great deal about physiology through his own academic study, but he studied everything all the time, and he watched the biomechanics. He did the weight training that was necessary to keep me from being injured, and basically, he did it all right. You know, I never really, other than the shin splints, once I got strong enough and got over those, I never had another injury until late in my career. So
that's interesting that you bring that up so early. Gosh, he. Basically, that idea at that time was revolutionary to use weight training and actual, for track athletes, let alone, you know, anyone that wasn't, you know, a power lifter at that time.
Exactly. At the time, and it was amazing. You wouldn't imagine that now, of course. It goes to the other extreme. But he did the weight training for the football team at the University of Michigan. They weren't doing it.
Wow.
And so he ended up helping to develop their weight training program. So he just looked at me, and he looked at where my muscle weakness was, and of course he watched me running and biomechanically could see what was, you know, what was needed, and I particularly needed to develop my quadriceps, and, you know, running kind of developed everything else, so he mostly had me concentrate at home on doing full squats without weights. And he started out having me, you know, I'd hang on to a chair and I'd do one-legged squats, and pretty soon I got to the point I could do full squats one-legged without holding on to anything, and so he had developed, and you could see the muscles just starting to develop.
Wow.
That's why I never had knee injuries, which are so prevalent.
Absolutely. No, gosh, that is amazing. That really is. God, that's fantastic.
But it's interesting that most of my competitors and the women I knew at that time during those years, some, I only had one competitor who constantly got injured, but I think she had biomechanical and structural issues, very high arches and kept getting stress fractures. But basically, we didn't have injuries. I mean, you know, athletes would pull muscles and things, but we didn't get the constant, what they now call overuse injuries.
Mm-hmm.
I was a coach for 26 years, so I'm very critical of that term.
Yes, ma'am.
But it is lack of preparation when they're young. And we get them as college coaches, and it would be impossible to catch up with a lot of them. You know, they'd get into college-level running, and they wouldn't have the development they needed from the time they were young to, you know, not be injured. So, you know, that's an aside, but when it was kind of remarkable back in the early 60s and throughout that era that those women who were running, and there were not that many of us, but we didn't have the percentage of injuries that athletes have now.
Right. Okay. So, start taking me through that first year where you're training with a coach, and mm-hmm. and then what are you working towards at that time?
Well, that's an interesting question, because in the entire premise of when I started training was we're training you for the Olympics. Now, that was rather intimidating.
Yeah, no kidding.
I basically didn't think about it that much. I just did what he asked me to do.
Right.
And I didn't even run a race until I'd been training from about, I think it was about October of that fall until March. Mm-hmm. Late March, perhaps, early April, the weather was enough to be running outdoors by then. And he was very canny about not wanting too much too soon and not sort of letting anybody see what I was doing at that point. So he took me to Chicago, and there was a big meet there in Soldier Field. And it was a Chicago Police Athletic League had a very active team by then. And it was a big meet, and ultimately one of my good friends, who was a Canadian competitor over the years, came down to run in that race. I was running 400 meters at the time. That's what he was training me for.
Wow.
I didn't even mention 800 meters to me at that point. That lap was enough for me to even imagine. So we get in the 400 meter race. It was a dirt track, cinders, and the gun goes off, and I take off, and somebody false started, but he hadn't told me what to do if I heard the gun again. So I had no idea what was going on. I just kept running, and so did my Canadian competitor, who was much more experienced. She wasn't about to let me go. So we ran half the race before they got us to come back. That was my first race, and that was out of state. And then we started running some little summer meets. They used to have what they called all-comers meets, and that was kind of all I had to do, in between going from, just a young girl running basically by myself and my coach,
sure,
to these little summer meets, and the next step was a national championship. So that's what he was, the next level before the Olympics was like an indoor nationals and an outdoor nationals. So that's what I really pointed towards after that first year.
Looking back, do you feel like you were isolated, or was Red so good that you, did you share what you were doing with friends or anything else? I mean, did you have any buddies?
I wouldn't call it isolated. It may be I was ultimately more of a loner than the typical high school student, because I was doing it by myself and I didn't have a team and nobody really paid any attention to what I was doing at school.
Right.
I was in a very big overcrowded high school. I have three schools in Ann Arbor now, but at that point, and they had to divide it and go to two schools by 1967. But in the early 60s, it was huge. It was overcrowded. It was overwhelming. I just felt like a nobody in high school anyway, so
right,
it was great to escape it. At one point, my coach, searching for facilities to run in, asked, they had a funny little track down in the basement of that school that the boys used,
uh-huh,
and he asked the athletic director if I could come and run, and he wouldn't let me. And he was a patient of my father's. That was ironic, too.
Goodness.
But he didn't care. He said, no girls allowed.
Oh, that's funny.
So that's what was going on. So in high school, they'd announce we'd go to all-comers meets in the winter now and then. There'd be a couple of them, and they'd announce the boys' result, and I would win my race, but they wouldn't announce my race. They refused to. So my sister, who was technically proficient even then, she was on what they call the AV club, I think, audio-visual.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
The nerds who ran the audiovisual programs.
Sure.
Away, and she insisted on announcing my results. So, we were trying to, kick them into the 20th century by then. But
that's great.
And I wasn't. No, go ahead.
No, please go.
Well, in terms of, again, not saying I was isolated, I was kind of on my own doing this stuff, but, the support I had from my coach and his wife, Betty, were so amazing. And then, and outside of my high school, people started to know about me because the newspaper started covering what I was doing.
Right.
And that meant the world to me. I was suddenly outside of the small world of high school and into the real world. I started interacting with college students who belonged to the Ann Arbor Track Club. I got to meet people who were older, and it really, I grew up a lot faster, I think. I just left the whole milieu of high school social life. I mean, I just didn't need it and didn't want it, and really moved ahead and enjoyed my interactions, and I made lifelong friends out of you know, people a few years older than I was.
Sure, absolutely. Oh, that's fantastic. What an opportunity.
It was.
Okay, so take me through, what was your first big meet that they had you go into?
All right, beyond those, that first Chicago experience and my all-comers meets would be the national championship. So I believe the first one was all the way out in western New York, and I remember we used to have to drive to these meets all the time. And
oh, yeah.
We did, and I was still running 400 meters at the time, and I did make the final that first time, so I really liked that. That kept me going, and I think I really trained for 400 meters for several years, thinking that was my event, but my coach knew all along he was gonna, you know, up the ante, and I was going to become a half-miler. So he was training me with that regard, but I think what really worked well for me was the fact that I was a sprint-trained middle-distance runner, ultimately.
Right.
Because by sprinting, I developed speed I wouldn't have developed otherwise. I had decent natural speed, but not crazy, not like the athletes now are born to run fast. I mean,
sure.
I was faster than most, but I had to develop the speed and the strength to really run it at a national, international level. And so those years of training as a quarter miler really, really made a difference. So that's what I did. And ultimately, then he started inching me into these longer repetitions and talking 800. And I was a little balky at first about it, but it all worked out. So that's what I moved into after about 3 years.
Okay. And what your first national, what year was that? Do you remember?
I am guessing it had to have been about 1964, maybe, because
okay.
I graduated from high school in 65, and by then, maybe it was probably 63, in fact, because by 65, when I graduated, I was already a contender for national teams and things, so in those 2 years, it made a big difference.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like you were pretty dedicated, and it didn't interfere with your schoolwork, for sure. Probably motivated you a little bit more.
Oh, yeah, I was even better. I mean, I found the high school social scene to be incredibly limiting, and so
yes,
you know, I was a good student, and I looked forward every day to running. And now, of course, they've discovered that is something young women. I mean, it's huge for them to be physically active. It enhances everything else they do: their sense of self, their self worth, their healthy attitude, their academics. It all makes a huge difference. And I was a coach for 26 years, so you know, I'm quite into the fact that it made a huge difference for me, and it did for most young women who came along after.
Yes, ma'am. That's something I believe in also. I believe physical activity and everything else helps anyone. genders quite the same.
Oh, sure. At whatever level. I mean, when I started coaching high school in Ann Arbor, finally, I was thrilled at the interactions that would happen between the boys and the girls' team.
Right.
Because they were so respectful of each other, and that was the difference.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, the kind of respect that boys would have for girls out of that, as opposed to some of the other kind of negative things that my era perpetuated, I should say. So,
sure.
You know, it really was a great eye-opener when that, in the early 70s, really started to happen.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, so let's talk about from the time you you finished high school and you're now actually starting to compete at a pretty darn high level and getting ready for basically the Olympics. So do you have any recollections between, you know, 65 and 68 that experiences?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, 65 was the first chance I had to make an international team. And in those years, we had a fantastic tradition of dual meets between the Soviet Union and satellite countries and the United States.
Wow.
And that was the one big international opportunity most of us female athletes had in track and field, because that was the money and the effort went towards those dual meets. And every other year, it would be in the Soviet Union somewhere. So then it allowed athletes to compete in Europe, which we had no opportunity to do otherwise. So, and even when it was in the United States, it was such a focus that it was amazing. So in 65, I was really ranked to the point where I should have probably been the number two runner and made that team because only two would get to go, and I blew it entirely. I was so nervous and so overwrought, and it was one of my, and being a sprinter, I tended to go out, but the turn would be go out too fast, and
yes,
I
ma'am.
Did. And I it was one of those situations where it was a death march to the finish line in the last few yards, and I got beaten and make the team.
Right.
So the next year, I did. I mean, it finally came together.
Yes.
And the year I didn't make the team was Europe, which I dearly wanted to go to. The year after, in 66, was the big meet. There were two actually scheduled. One was in Berkeley. And that was going to be with, you know, all the United States athletes and a lot of the other countries, not the Soviet Union, but other countries, Poland and some of those.
Right.
And then it was going to be an L.A. Coliseum with the Soviet Union. The big, big kahuna was the dual meet.
Yes, ma'am.
So I was competing for my club. By then we had a little club. We had young athletes younger than I who were competing, and we were in a junior national championship in out somewhere in Missouri, and the heat, it was like 100 degrees, and we were running, and then suddenly all hell broke loose, basically. There was a huge airline walkout, so all the airlines were grounded, and the Soviet Union boycotted the dual meet, and this was over the escalation in Vietnam.
Right.
So this is part of history that a lot of people don't know is where these boycotts started and why, but because the U.S. was escalating in Vietnam,
yes, ma'am.
The Soviets took a stand and boycotted the meet. So I finally got a plane. I was able to get to L.A. and had to get up to Berkeley and sort of made my way, one way or another, got my way up there, and they were trying to scramble to put together meets because all the Eastern Bloc countries were out. They weren't coming.
Right.
And so what they did, they used to have what they called the British Empire Games. They became the British Commonwealth Games, and those athletes had been in the Caribbean, and the U.S. pulled together the money and brought all those teams over to California. And we had those two meets, you can go back in history and look, were incredible. Jim Ryan smashed the world record in the mile in Berkeley, and all of us ran like crazy. We had wonderful competition.
Wow.
And then the meet in L.A. Coliseum, pretty much against the same teams, and that included, it was a big group of people from all over, the Australians, the Caribbean athletes, everybody. And there were world records that fell right and left.
Wow.
And I was ranked in the top 10 in the world with my race. So, you know, it was just an amazing outcome for such a, you know, such a disappointment that it initially was.
Sure.
So that was 66.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, then I was headed. I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was headed straight to Mexico by then.
Yes,
my
ma'am.
Coach actually was named the team coach. They had a pre-Olympic beat in 1967 in Mexico. And my coach was the head coach for that, and I was training for that, and then I ended up getting injured. It was really out of the blue. We had no understanding of what it was in those days. I think it turned out that it was IT band syndrome, but nobody knew what it was.
And yes, ma'am.
My legs just, I couldn't run
all
summer. So I missed that meet. I missed the Pan Am Games. All the things I needed to develop, I thought, for Mexico.
Right.
So that was, and then I got appendicitis when I started training and had surgery in the fall. So I had a big setback. It was as if I'd lost everything. I mean, I really felt like this is not going to happen for me.
Right.
Because I haven't trained, I haven't raced, I haven't had any opportunity to prepare for this huge year. So it was really a downer, and I got through the indoor season. Things started to come around, and then everybody had to, and this is another subject I'm sure you'll get to, but then everybody had to prepare and worry about running at high altitude.
Right.
We had our national championship, and I had run in Albuquerque. I probably ran that year. They ran the indoors in Albuquerque, and I was still running 800 meters, so I didn't have any particular effect, although my dad's old medical partner, who had moved out to Arizona, he came to Albuquerque to watch me run. He was picking up my fingers and saying, they're blue. You know, they were all worrying about oxygen.
Right.
So that was at 5,000 feet, and then we ran the national championships in Denver, also at 5,000 feet outdoors, and the trials, of course, even higher, but we ran the trials kind of think back now. But in any case, everybody was worrying about Mexico at whatever it was, 7,800 feet. I don't know. It was over 7,000 feet now.
Yes, ma'am.
So,
Were you at University of Michigan at this time?
Yes, I was a Michigan student by then, yeah. Right. And in fact, that year I had decided that winter I withdrew from school for the time being for that term, and for the fall semester should I make the team. So I worked as a waitress on the side. That's what I had to do to pay my travel expenses. So I worked at a German restaurant in town and worked as a waitress. So that's what I did and trained that winter. But in any case, so I was free in May to go. My coach set me up to go out to Denver and stay with the family, and it turned out to be pretty disastrous. The family were great, but it was out of my milieu. I was out of my training. Going out for a few weeks to train at altitude did not help.
Oh, wow.
And I was sick. It was just not. So it was another setback. So I entered the main part of the summer season not emotionally prepared at all. It was really hard for me to get myself in shape, and I battled and battled and battled to get into running weight, to get myself in shape, to get my mind in shape to get this done. And as it turned out, at the national championships, I beat my big rival, Madeline Manning, right at the finish line. So that was at high altitude, at least at Denver.
Uh-huh.
And then we went to the trials where it wasn't at altitude. The trials for women were at Pomona in California, Cal Poly Pomona.
Sure, yes, ma'am.
And the men were up at Lake Tahoe, so they were at altitude and we weren't. So I ran the trials and did the same stupid thing. I went out like a crazy person and got beaten at the finish line. I got beaten. I was fourth.
Wow.
And I didn't make the top three. I had the summer, I guess I'd made the Olympic standard before I was injured previous year in L.A., but I still had to make the Olympic standard. I still knew there was a chance I could make the team because the woman who beat me was the national champion in the 400 meters and was on the team at 400 meters and didn't want to run the 800 meters. And so, you know, there was a chance. So I got through the rest of those few weeks, and at the Canadian National Exposition, they always had a big meet up there, and I had almost half given up that it was going to happen by then. We had a big race up there, and it started to rain, and they held the meet off, and I was standing under the stands. The rain was dripping, and I was just so relaxed. I almost had just finally stopped overthinking everything.
Uh-huh.
And when I went out there, I ran my 205, ran the Olympic standard, and made the team that went up to high-altitude training at that point. Uh-huh. I hadn't made the Olympic team yet, but I made the training team.
Sure.
And then we went through at Los Alamos, which was up there in the mountains of New Mexico. It was really an interesting experience. You know, we had to fight the altitude. It was really hard.
Uh-huh.
We trained, and I had a training partner in Doris Brown, who was another 800-meter runner. She and I trained similarly. We liked training together. We had done so, you know, when we were in L.A. and Berkeley that summer, too. Madeline Manning, the other 800-meter runner who was the champion, she trained on her own. She always kept to herself.
Okay.
And Doris and I trained really well and really hard, and we ran a race at the end of that training session, and I ran really well. The woman who was the quarter miler dropped out, didn't have any intention of running 800 meters, and so we were really sick after the race. I mean, it took a while. I was sick.
Right.
As most of us were, and then back when we were back in the hotel is when we were all comparing notes. We all got there, and somehow this delayed reaction, everybody was kind of passing out, blacking out briefly because of the altitude.
Right.
But we went through at that point, after that meet was over, was when the final team had to be decided. And there were some very strange goings on. This is quite a story, actually, because there were some coaches who were kind of unscrupulous and bad people, to tell you the truth.
Yes, ma'am.
And the one who was coaching the quarter miler, who had beaten me, he didn't care, in a way, if she didn't run the 800, but he wanted to be sure I didn't. It was that kind of attitude.
Oh, wow.
And so he was kind of politicking with our officials out in the lobby of the hotel where they were having their meeting, and the women on the team, including Jarvis Scott, who was the quarter miler, but Wyoming Tyus and other women on the team who were my friends,
yeah,
we climbed out of a window, went around the back of the hotel, and went back and signed the papers.
Wow.
Away from the coach, and that made me a part of the Olympic team.
Wow.
Well, it was really wild.
Yeah, well,
it was not the way I would have liked to make it, but
no, that's what's interesting. What was his grudge or his beef against you? I mean, do you have any idea?
He didn't know me personally, and unfortunately, well, you know, you will, as you mentioned, as it was mentioned in the cover letter, there was a, and I will say, it was a time of huge uproar and upheaval in our country.
Oh, absolutely.
And civil rights were an issue. L.A., this was a team with black athletes.
Right.
He was an old school. I mean, there were other old school people who were wonderful, and he was not. He did not want me on that team for
wow.
his own personal reasons. He, you know, that was what was going on, whereas my friends on the team were black and white, and it was Wyoming.
Right. You were just athletes. I truly know how that is.
Yeah, I mean, they wanted things to work out between all of us.
Absolutely.
And knew what was going on. So that's a big part of it. That's what led to all the behind the scenes.
Wow. That's amazing. Gosh. All right. And okay, so now by a little political maneuvering on you and your team's part, you're on the Olympic team. So that's awesome. How did that feel after that? It's like, okay, well, this is the way it's supposed to go anyway. So
yeah, once you're on the team, I mean, it just was amazing. I you know, I stopped overthinking. I must admit I was just so thrilled and looking forward to being there and experiencing all of this. I you know, wished that I'd had more international experience. I had almost none.
Uh-huh.
And going into this incredible experience, I mean, it was just washing over me like it was all new. And I wish I'd had more experience to take it all in 100%.
Sure.
Because that's advice I give to young athletes myself. I was so lucky to have the chance to go back and run in Munich, because then I knew how to absolutely open my eyes, ears, everything, and enjoy every aspect of the experience. I enjoyed a great deal of it, but I was also terrified of the race. I was, you know, I wasn't quite what I wanted to be.
Yes, ma'am.
When it came to it. So I, you know, but the experience was just awesome from the minute I joined the team.
Did you guys train? Did the women's track team actually train in Denver? Or where did you guys do your altitude training?
We went back to Denver briefly. We went to Denver just to assemble.
Uh-huh.
Basically, is what happened. Then once we left Los Alamos, team was named. We went home for a while. I can't remember how long, and you know, assembled in Denver after that. And so the, you know, it was all about going on, fitting the uniforms, getting everything together, and it was about meant to be maybe 2 or 3 days. And then the riots in Mexico broke out.
Right.
And it was, I later met someone who had been studying down there, who was near it and saw, I mean, there were shootings, and you know, everybody knew that the social fabric there was very tenuous. I mean, it was, you know, people knew that and how poor people were and how much extreme differences there were. They gave people paint to paint their poor little hovels around the airport and put up fences so nobody'd see it. You know, that sort of thing led to those riots.
Sure.
And so we sat in Denver wondering if the Olympics were going to be called off. I mean, that's how bad it was.
Right. Oh, so you absolutely knew all about it.
Oh, yeah, they had chartered planes, and the planes were already ferrying athletes from Denver in all the different sports down there, and where we were on the schedule to go down there, we were held up because of these riots, and we were wondering what was going to happen. You know, we thought it was all over for a while there.
Wow.
But luckily, we ended up getting to fly down there, and what was cool was these chartered planes, they had a big Olympic insignia on them, and it was so cool. You know, it was the old days where you walk out on the tarmac and climb up the stairs, and you see these jets with the, you know, the Olympic insignia on them. It was sort of like the Air Force One looks now, you know.
Sure, absolutely. That's awesome. Before we take the flight down to Mexico City, I wanted to ask about when you were training, and you said you got back after the, you know, races in Albuquerque, or at least in training, you guys were almost passed out. Did you guys not get were there not medical or athletic trainers running around helping you guys? Or
we had a medical person with us, but everything was unknown at that time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we were taken care of. That wasn't the issue. It's just that nobody knew what to expect.
Sure.
So, you know, we didn't hurt ourselves or anything. I mean, you know, I've been sick after races in the past, but this was about as sick as I could imagine. You know, I was half passed out on the ground after the race, and then everybody was really pretty altitude sick, I would call it.
Sure.
You know, after we got back to the hotel, but they were just learning, and they were well prepared in Mexico to the point where what we went through at Los Alamos. And not being a 10,000-meter runner, there was quite a difference. I don't think they could have made up that gap, but for us in the 800, it didn't matter. I had no problem with the altitude once we got to Mexico.
Outstanding.
And what happened after my race was, they had medical personnel with stretchers and oxygen by the finish line. And no matter what, if you looked a little tired, they'd come running up to you, and they did to me. I was just standing there with my hands on my knees, and I ran away. But I'm fine. So they were prepared to be sure nobody died at the altitude, and of course nobody did.
Right. Oh, that's great. Besides Doris, did you get really close with any of your other teammates?
Well, oh, sure. And actually, my very best friend all the time was a grad student at Michigan who was a kayaker, and her sister was a bronze medalist in Tokyo.
Oh, wow.
And then she and her sister were both on the Olympic team, and they had a friend who was a Hungarian that their mother was a lawyer. They got him out of Tokyo. He defected, and they helped him defect to the United States. He was actually with the team and didn't compete until the following Olympics, but he was with the canoeist.
Wow.
And another Michigan student was on the team, Toby, I forget his last name, but anyway, he was on the canoeing team, so I knew a lot of people, but Barry was my very closest friend.
Wonderful.
And she was there, and of course, I was close to a lot of people that I competed against for years, and, you know, we just had a great time.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And you were talking about knowing about all the riots and actually the massacre before you went down there. Did you hear anything about the Project for Human Rights or the Harvard Crew Letter? Did you have any...
Vague things. I mean, we knew there was a lot boiling over. You know, all this was going on. The activists from San Jose State and, of course, the black athletes on the team were, you know, everybody was well aware. I mean, we had the Martin Luther King Games had been established. You know, of course, all of the things that had gone on, the assassinations, the riots. You know, we had riots in Detroit in 1967. You know, it was just all out there. And this time of huge transition and conflict was going on. It was so focused on civil rights, and of course, women's rights were not in the forefront at that point, but they were grumbling along, you know, at the same time.
Yes, ma'am.
We were all treated like distaff on the team when we were women. It was bad enough that you were black, and they still, I would refer you to the Olympic book, and they called even then, when they knew all this was going on, and wrote up, you know, this really nice yearbook. I don't know if you've seen it. You probably have it with your archives for all the Olympic teams, but they used the term colored even then.
Oh, yes,
so
ma'am.
Everybody was saying black, and they used terms like this with women. If you look at who wrote that book, all the different writers, they were all men.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the list of Olympic Committee members, the USOC, every one of them man.
Right.
No women at all. And they used terms like curd and dimpled and girls, and, of course, the term colored. Olympic darlings were always named, you know.
Yes, ma'am.
Based on how they looked. I mean, that was all going on. That was underlying the whole feminist thing was still underlying the major issues with civil rights that were in the front. I mean, everybody knew this was going on, and we'd have a lot of, you know, connection with our black teammates who were, you know, really involved in it.
Yes, ma'am.
And we were so lucky to, you know, be able to share our lives and get to know each other and things like that. When the Black Power demonstration happened, it was just staggering. The reaction, the old men of the USOC were harassing the other Black athletes, and I won't name them, but one I was in an elevator with was heading to his final, where he set a world record. He was in tears over this.
Right.
You know, he was obviously very impacted by the civil rights movement and needed that movement, but on the other hand, he was there to compete.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm not saying a thing about the power salute. I'm saying a thing about the fact that the USOC wouldn't recognize the rights of athletes and the impact in the world that this was having, and didn't show some respect for the athletes. Instead, harassed them and threatened them and told them they'd be sent home. You know, things like that were just bad. And it was a cloud at that point, a real cloud over some people's experience.
Oh, absolutely. Gosh, I can imagine. And it, I mean, looking back through the lens of some time and some now, it's like how these, you know, just the perception is like how could you treat athletes like this? You know, I mean, seriously, you know, threaten, they've sacrificed everything to do this for their country, basically, and then you treat them like this.
Oh, yeah, and the whole attitude, I would say, that comes through even when you're reading the Olympic book is patronizing.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Because the old men of the USOC, and I will say men because, as I said, there wasn't one woman among them, and the only women we knew that were involved with our track and field for women were throwbacks to them.
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, they treated us the same way.
Right, exactly.
I was 21 years old by then, and I was treated like a child.
Yeah.
And you know, I was patronized by the men. It was pretty amazing. They were rude and mean to the women.
Yeah.
Probably the same way if you happened to, you know, be, as they said, colored. They were probably very patronizing. And there were, you know, terms that were used even in the write-up in the Olympic book about how surprised everybody was that the Mexicans could do what they did, like they were dumb or something, you
right.
know? And it was just sad that part of it, but it was exciting on the positive side to see how people stood up, you know, how people stood up for each other and how we were a part of something that we knew was going to change the world. And it did.
Right, absolutely. And I think it probably, looking back and being an outsider, looking back, it helped coalesce you as a team more than a lot of others like we've touched on, and we'll continue to
right.
touch on that.
Oh yeah. Oh, definitely.
Okay, so you get on a plane, you're going down to Mexico City. What are your impressions when you're getting off the plane?
Well, like I say, it was driving through the signs they tried to hide of the abject poverty on the outskirts of the city, and we didn't really get into the city as a team at all. We just, some of us, when we finished later, got to, you know, get into the city and see more. But
sure.
Getting into the village, of course, it was just, I mean, I was beside myself with excitement. We were in a bus, and we were trapped in there while they were getting us all sort of, you know, checked in or whatever, and I was practically beating, you know, there were athletes outside the windows saying, hi, come on out, you know, and we were in the bus beating on the windows practically wanting to get out. It was just incredibly exciting in the village. It was just beautiful. It was so great. Flags everywhere, you know.
Yes, ma'am.
Amazing. And so much excitement and so much, it was really happy
mm-hmm.
by then. It was just, everybody was just full of excitement. It was just great.
Cool. How many days or weeks before opening ceremonies did you arrive?
We had about a week.
Okay.
And it was, you know, it was still really hot there. I remember we had a, you know, we were training in 100 degree heat and stuff like that. But it was okay. I mean, by then we were pretty well acclimated at our distances to the altitude, and the fact the climate, it was so dry, it was better than what we'd experienced in the U.S.
Absolutely.
Well, it really wasn't bad, even though it was very hot. So that heat started to dissipate by the time the the opening ceremonies came along. So, you know, there was, the rainy season began. They kept saying the rainy season brings in more oxygen or whatever. You could see from the pictures people were standing in the rain. Bob Beamon, it was starting to rain when he did his amazing long jump. I was sitting up in the stands, and it was rainy, and he was out there. Suddenly just flew. Anyway.
Sure.
So we had, you know, we had weather that was decent, and a lot of clear days, a lot of spectacular kind of fun things that went on, and lots of cultural activities even in the village.
Sure. What'd you think of the facilities?
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful facilities, as usual, just like with London. Everybody else was sniping and griping and saying they're never going to be finished. And they were. They were beautiful. And we had what they did, and what was interesting, there was even what they had excavated for this big village, which ended up becoming apartments.
Uh-huh.
There was even some dome structure that looked like an old pyramid, you know. It was just amazing. But the high-rise apartment blocks were kind of, they were just cement.
Right.
And they had windows, but that was about it. We each had cots, and, you know, I didn't care. It was just,
it doesn't matter, right?
Attention. We didn't spend a lot of time in there, to be honest.
Sure.
Out and about. But it was fine. You know, it was just empty and not carpeted and not luxurious, but it was perfectly fine, and it worked just fine. It was great.
So. How many roommates did you have?
Let's see. I think we had, everything seemed, as I recall, very open. My roommate was my good friend, Sperry.
Yeah.
And she shared this one room, but everybody else was kind of out there. You know, you just had these big open areas and rooms, you know, kind of merging in. And so you were kind of aware of all your teammates around. So it was great.
Yeah, great. What do you remember the food or anything?
Food was an issue. The food was interesting. We had our own. There was a big... there was a huge pavilion, you know, closed in where they had the dining hall.
Yes, ma'am.
And each country had their own section because I think we were next to the Japanese because we had our own sort of food and they kept bringing in, you know, kind of bottles of raw-looking things and they ate totally differently than we did. And they had lines where you would stand, you know, everybody was concerned about tourista. It was a very serious issue.
Sure.
And so there was a hand-washing area before you even walked in.
Mm-hmm.
And we used only bottled water to brush our teeth, so there were bins of, I got to like these cookies they had along with bananas and the bottled water. Those were our snacks, so we always were able to get those. And, you know, we just had regular American food once we were in there, so it was good. And we shared, you know, the dining hall with similar cultural eating habits, you know, Australians and people like that. So.
Right. Did you participate in the opening ceremonies?
Oh, yes. Luckily, you know, the swimmers and divers had to think twice, and I think, I'm trying to remember the gymnasts, but most of them marched. You know, some would stay out if they were competing the next day because it really was a very physically demanding event. They had everything organized. You had to take buses over from where the village was to the stadium.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a long bus ride, but it was a bus ride. And these buses from the early morning lined up in vast lines. And it was all very orchestrated. We had no trouble getting over to the stadium. Outside the stadium, there was a big open field. No trees, but there we were in the sun and the heat.
Right.
And you know, we were kind of in groupings as where we'd march in. And so they had us, you know, in the right order. And we got to interact with a lot of other athletes. It was really fun, you know, whether it was Italians or French or British, and they were all, the guys especially, you know, guys, how they are, they were all hooting and hollering and teasing each other and flirting with us, and everybody's taking pictures, and it was just fun.
Oh, yeah.
The problem, we just sat on the grass and tried to stay relaxed, and they had these, and they were in the stadium too, these young fellows who would carry Coca-Cola packs on their back, and they had like a hose, and they just, you know, they would dispense Coca-Cola in these cups.
Wow.
Their backpack Cokes, and so everybody was drinking Cokes, not water, I think, by then, but, but it was, but, you know, you waited and waited, it was hours.
Oh, yeah.
But it went off without a hitch, and that's when kind of the enormity of it hit me, because I wished I had been a little even more open. It was just almost terrifying by then. It was so exciting and great, but it was, I didn't take it in as well as I wanted to.
Yeah. Were you almost overwhelmed when you walked into, from what I've heard from other Olympians, the emotion and the greeting that the U.S. team was spectacular when you guys walked into the stadium.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you knew that in those years, the world was our friend, almost all of them. I mean, people loved the Americans. We got that even in the Soviet, in Russia, when we went to, I went on to meet there eventually, and people really admired and loved the Americans, and we got a great, overwhelming greeting, and when your foot, it was just kind of a, there was a ramp, a downhill, when you walked in the stadium, and you walk in out of the shadow into this vast, I mean, it was just beyond imagining what it would really be like, and it was just great. I mean, you know, and I liked, I must admit, I'm old school.
Yes, ma'am.
Kind of like the idea that we were a little more disciplined. We were told we had to march, you know, in order, and you
can see
from the pictures, we're not dangling cameras and wandering around and self-aggrandizing and, you know, promoting ourselves. I'm not real happy with that kind of an entrance that, you know, may be free and everything nowadays, but I liked what we did, and it was full of dignity, and it was just great.
Great. No, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I must admit. things have changed to the opposite. 180 degree turn isn't always the best, but anyway.
Yes, ma'am. But maybe we're going to see a turn back towards. So everything has its swing, doesn't it?
Yeah. I wish it would kind of swing a little to the middle.
Yes, ma'am. You were talking about interacting with some of the other teams. Did you have interactions with any of the Soviet bloc countries?
Yes, actually, that was the other friend that I especially stayed in touch with after the Olympics, was Ludmila Bragina, who was the Russian 800-meter runner, or Soviet at that time, and she started writing. We wrote back and forth in French, which was my college language.
Oh, outstanding.
And then she actually learned English, so we kept in touch that way. So actually, even during that era, we were able to write to each other, and we did. I mean, she made a very good friend of herself to me, and ended up being the Olympic champion in Munich when we both moved up to 1,500 meters. But anyway, it was great to have her as a friend. Yes, indeed.
Absolutely. What was your impressions? Did you have any interactions with the East Germans or?
Not specifically with East Germans in Mexico. I wasn't aware. They weren't as prevalent, then they became very prevalent in Munich. But
yes, ma'am.
But the Soviets were very prevalent, and I traded something. I think I traded something from my parade uniform with a Polish woman, and so I have her parade dress. And,
wow.
You know, we traded stuff. And
sure.
You have pins. I mean, that's the neat, you know, they give you lots of Olympic pins, and you get, the main thing was to get to trade Olympic pins. So they had you know, it was like a recreation hall, but they didn't have dancing. They didn't have a disco or anything.
Uh-huh.
And so we just kind of hung around and traded pins, and that was a big evening event. I mean, everybody wanted to do that. And I remember some of the athletes on the team, including Lee Evans, the quarter miler, they wanted to dance. So they somehow, how they managed to do it, they got a hold of speakers, music, plugged it in, and we made our own disco, which became a real, you know, they did that every year after that, but we got to have our own disco and dancing and trading pins, and yes, the whole deal was interacting with everybody. So
right.
It was great.
Oh, that's fantastic! Gosh, that's amazing to me. Actually, that you knew enough French that you guys could converse, you know, in French as opposed to, you know, she speaking Russian or whatever her native.
Oh yeah. I was very impressed. I thought with the education the Soviets had. I mean, I thought they were very highly educated and disciplined, and you know, so I felt she was better at the language than I was. I could write it better than I could speak it, but in any case, then she learned English, so that was even easier.
Okay, so how long after the opening ceremonies was your event?
We were the second week.
Okay.
And I'm losing track of exact days, but of course we got to watch you know, swimming, and I watched what turned out to be, of course, a huge event, which was the Soviet Czechoslovakian water polo.
Wow. Yeah. And that was blood. That was blood in the water.
They bled in the water, and they were battling each other, I mean, really hard. You know, they were fighting each other in the pool. It was
absolutely.
Really
wow.
Got to go to Sochomilco, which is where all the rowing and kayaking and canoeing was because of my friends there. So I got to do some, you know, see some things that I might not have otherwise seen. And it was fun to watch. Even my friend Sperry's sister, who was the incoming medalist from Tokyo in the bronze medal, you know, they get in their kayaks, which are what you would call tippy. The racing kayaks and canoes have no keel, and they're, you know.
Yes, ma'am. They're very shallow.
Part of the body, but if they get out there in the morning to train, and they'd just be tired, and they'd be tipping over in the cold water all the time and everything. It was really fun to watch them, though. So, and got to watch them, the rowing, of course.
That's fantastic that you took the opportunity at your first Olympics to see so many other events.
Oh, yeah, and it got better. It was hard to, you know, you couldn't get into some of the events, like gymnastics and some of them. In Munich, it was a lot easier because our big recreation hall had, by that time, had giant big screen TVs, and we could sit and watch what we couldn't get into.
Right.
You know, to watch events so we could keep up with everything else that was going on. It wasn't easy to do that in Mexico, but we kept up with what we could, and mostly the excitement of seeing your teammates coming back with medals, and they also carried a box. They'd give the hand them an olive garland in a box.
Right.
It was tradition, so we got to watch them coming and going with all that.
That's exciting. I mean, and God, that really is. How was your feeling about security? I mean, you at this time, from what I understand, I mean, as long as you had a uniform on, you could probably get into most events in 68.
Yeah, I mean, that was fine. And security, I mean, there was a gate around the village, but we never felt that, and it was wide open. We almost got to the point where it was too much, but it was still wonderful. What the Olympic Committee and government had done was in a way to give something back to the people, was really encourage them to be part of it, and so they'd open those gates up, and all these children would come in, and autograph-seeking was their thing during the whole Olympics.
Right.
So they'd be all over the village, and it got to the point if you had to get from point A to point B, I mean, I had no problem signing autographs, but you'd have to take off and run from one door to the next because you'd be followed by hordes of little children
who
just couldn't wait. But they were wonderful, and I've got fabulous pictures of little kids. I signed a baby. His father would put a little white undershirt on his baby, a little thing, maybe 6 months, 8 months old, and you'd sign the shirt.
Uh-huh.
And then there was another picture of this old wrecked old car, and you'd sign the car. It was, signing autographs was really fun, and it was funny too. So that was a big part of it.
Okay, now it's coming up to your race. Tell me about the prelims and.
Well, that's as far as I got, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I was not happy with at that point with how I mentally prepared for it. I didn't compete as well as I should have, and I have to, you know, kind of rest on that and say I'm glad I got to the next. To the next Olympics because I could do much better.
Sure.
You know, we had our ups and downs. I mean, they made us sit on a bench. I mean, we couldn't even warm up.
Wow.
We warmed up in the field and they sat us on a bench forever, but that's not the real issue. I knew that my lack of experience had hit me and I was totally unprepared mentally to run the best race I should. I didn't run as fast as I should have.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't make the semifinals, so I wasn't proud of my race per se, but I stayed on my feet and I competed and wished for more. So
right. Well, that's a, you got another chance. So that's quite honest.
And it was interesting because I was 21.
Yes, ma'am.
I was in college.
Right.
And we still didn't have a college team, but It was interesting in those days with women athletes, it was always young women. And it's as if they were always promoting these 15-year-olds over those of us who really, if they knew their physiology down the road, would have realized we were only starting to come into our own at that age.
Right.
And they just basically overlooked us. I mean, they, the Olympic organizers,
wow,
committee people that we dealt with at the national level, you know, all those people, just there's always the new young thing coming along. And, you know, you never really got a lot of support from them. But I didn't care because I had so much support at home that it didn't matter, and I knew I was only getting better. So.
Sure, absolutely. Coach was there, right?
Red and Betty, but, you know, I didn't see them for the longest time. And they had been there before, of course, because he'd been the team coach the prior year. And I began to wonder what had happened, and it turned out they had gotten deadly sick. They were laid up. They rented a little apartment. They'd both gotten dysentery and were deadly sick for days and days. And finally they showed up, and they were gray as could be. They'd been so sick, but they got there in time, and so we got to hang out after that.
Sure.
So they got to experience it, and they were very proud. It was a big deal because they had been the key.
Absolutely. Absolutely,
and I there.
And I know you weren't pleased, but how did you react with how you did run your heats? Did you carry with it you for a while, or did you like, well, I'm just happy to still be here, or how did you react?
I didn't go around talking about my poor race or anything. I just threw myself into the experience of others and watching the events and enjoying that, and not, you know, just thinking ahead and enjoying what I was experiencing off the track. So
sure, absolutely. You became just as much a good team member, it sounds like, than anything else.
Oh, that was the key, was everybody was a team member. Everybody was a good team member. They were so supportive of each other. That was terrific. So, we got all the way to the end with the marathon. I had good friends, one marathoner, Kenny Moore, and got to know a lot of the other distance runners. And, you know, I trained with them a little bit, too, sometimes. So it was really fun to watch them.
Sure. Absolutely. Do you remember did they come up to you about testing for banned substances or anything else?
Because
this was,
you know,
the very first Olympics
did that. The whole steroid thing was, you know, it was just starting to penetrate our consciousness that this was going on.
Yes, ma'am.
And it was going on more with the men, but our shot putter, I think we only might have had one who qualified. And she was a big girl, but she didn't go near steroids. And she knew even then that what she was up against were the press sisters and, you know, uh-huh, the Eastern Bloc athletes who the women were into it.
Yes, ma'am.
You heard the men talking about it. I mean, they were taking them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before it hadn't been illegal. So, you know, the testing, it was interesting. I didn't really know because they weren't testing everybody.
Right.
We didn't get tested. We did get put into a test where they used us as guinea pigs, and, you know, from, I don't know that they do that anymore, certainly without permission, but they just basically said, you're going to be tested. And they were taking cheek swabs and doing testing on a variety of exotic things, like, you know, bitter, sweet. They were doing all kinds of studies of athletes, and
uh-huh,
these were mostly, I think, Mexican academics, but there might have been international academics, although, so we did, you know, we got involved in some of that. I just hope they don't clone me down the road. Now you have to worry about these things and say, I don't want to be tested, you know.
What about gender testing?
Trying to remember, they didn't do that until Munich, that I recall. They were pulling hair out of our head to do that.
Yeah, actually 68 was the very first time they actually did that.
Well, maybe the cheek squats.
Yeah.
Swab was part of that.
That was part of it. Yes, ma'am. That's exactly right.
That's what it was, of course. Yeah, so that was interesting. But
well,
if they didn't chase us down and, you know, make us go through drug testing at that point.
Absolutely.
And it was so random, even in Munich, because one of my teammates, Francie LaRue, and we were both semifinalists, she got tested and I didn't, so it was still random, and she was suffering. They kept feeding her beer, you know, getting her to drink beer until she could produce the sample. So
right, absolutely. Well, banned substances and gender testing was a first here at 68.
Yeah.
And I know in your later years, I mean, you were not only so affected by Title IX, you became a champion in later years, because you absolutely have been in athletics and athletic administration your whole career, basically. So from your life experiences, do you think that we've come a long way from, obviously, the barriers that you had to overcome, and where you were treated as just such an afterthought, as not even an athlete, it sounds like. Tell me some recollections, what you like about what has come to pass since then, especially Title IX. Issues.
Oh, I mean, it's just opportunity, opportunity, opportunity.
Yes, ma'am.
That's what it was. We were so limited in our opportunity, and yet I personally had that opportunity, and it was very special. And when I became a coach, I was humbled by the difference in my experience and their experience. I, from day one, had a personal coach. Mm-hmm. I was it. I was the queen, you know. I didn't have to battle to find my way into that milieu, and every young girl who would come along at the high school, young high school level that I started coaching, you know, they had dozens and dozens of other girls who wanted to do this, so you had to really get your head together to, you know, go after it.
Yes, ma'am.
It was a different experience, and I was humbled by it, if anything, because it was, in some ways, it was harder. I had the best of both worlds in that sense. I missed out on the team event, the team experience, and I was real disappointed that that had never happened. But in other ways, you know, I was lucky. So then when these opportunities came along for everybody to participate and move through the system to get to the levels that I, you know, to seek those levels that I had achieved, you know, it was wonderful, but the battles never ended. I mean, they were still going on when I ended my coaching career. So,
yes,
you know, it's still going on, and it's taken a back seat, and it's kind of different now. I think most schools provide pretty good opportunity for women now, and they're certainly not being put down and denigrated for doing what they do. They're not being told they have, their muscles are too big, or they're not feminine, they're not ladylike. Those things held us back in many ways. You know,
oh, absolutely.
They didn't intimidate me. I basically became a rebel and just said, you know, you're not going to tell me what I'm going to be. And that was good. That,
yes, ma'am.
I guess made me more of a feminist in the best sense of the word, and more of a fighter for the young women who came after me.
Yes, ma'am.
And I did have to fight, and I did have to lose a lot. So, you know, it was interesting.
Sure, absolutely. I think what's interesting is you've spent a lot of years at a good, I'll call it progressive, at least forward-thinking university, like University of Michigan, just like the University of Texas, are very, very similar kinds of campuses.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to avail opportunities, they have, both institutions have long histories of that. So I think that probably helped quite a bit in development post-Olympics for you. Would you agree?
Well, Michigan was one of the later developers, to
right.
tell you the truth. But I came back from two Olympics, and they finally had a women's national championship at the collegiate level. I was told they weren't interested in sending me to a national championship to represent my school.
Wow.
So, you know, we had in place an athletic director at Michigan who was absolutely hated women's athletics. We had appointed a woman from the phys ed department who didn't like other women, and she told
awesome.
Me, Francie, you'd have to make the team like everybody else, and you don't have, and we don't have a team. And they had no interest in sending me to compete for the, you know, to win two national championships.
Right.
I mean, that was what was going on at Michigan, and by the time I started coaching at Michigan, it hadn't gotten much better because the same people were in place.
That's amazing.
So it was a battle all the way. I coached from 1981 to 1984 at Michigan, moved on to a southern school where it was even worse. So I never got out of that. Michigan finally caught up, and now they're way up there.
Right.
It took a long, long time. It took longer than a lot of other Big Ten schools, to be honest.
Yeah, sure.
Texas was ahead of them. And it's about people. It's about who's in charge.
Exactly.
Who has the foresight to see you're not going to battle this forever. You know, Title IX almost died on the vine.
Right.
For years.
Yes,
until
ma'am.
They came up with some other legal ploys, which haven't been the best approach, but it's forced people to make changes.
Well, you've...
It's hurt men. I mean, you know, my husband's a men's coach.
Yep.
When they cut back men's teams, that's not what they should have been doing.
Agreed.
But, you know, that's what they did because they waited so long to find any sense of equity.
Agreed. That's great.
That's where things have gone.
No,
thank
you for sharing that. No, I think that's. I absolutely agree with you. I didn't know how to otherwise broach the subject without.
Oh yeah, well, I won't get started too long because that's the thing of the past. But in the end, it ended my career at Wake Forest University.
Oh wow!
Wouldn't put up with it any longer. I took legal action,
yes,
won the battle, and lost the war. So that's what the end of my career was. They got rid of me. So
well, you lost your
feminist era. So that when I tried to stand up for the women on the team,
yeah.
They didn't understand what I was standing up for. It was a strange era.
Wow.
For example, give you one example.
Sure.
I won't say any more. But
no,
the example was that, you know, Wake Forest is in the Atlantic Coast Conference. They have big-time basketball. They have pretty darn good football, and certainly in the conference. And they have VIP boxes, right, in both stadiums. So
yes,
they started asking the women on the women's team to be, I call them serving girls, hostesses in the VIP boxes. And I said, what are they doing?
Athletes.
They're greeting and greeting and handing out drinks and, you know, just socializing. I said, well, are you asking Tim Duncan to do that? Because he was on our team at that time.
Right, absolutely.
And are you asking the soccer players, you know, the men? Well, no, the girls are so charming, blah, blah. I said, they're not doing it, not my team.
Wow.
And I stood up for it. I said, you know, Minnesota has a lawsuit going on right now over that very issue. They didn't care. And I stood up for him, and I said to the women on my team, I said, you're not doing it. And not only did the administration not understand it, my own team didn't understand it.
Wow.
So, you know, it was a tough time.
Absolutely. Wow. 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 Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Back to Mexico. Do you remember Smith and Carlos's protest? And do you remember when that happened?
Well, it was after the 200, so
right.
Happened before Lee Evans ran the 400. You know, that's all I just remember what a controversy it was, as I had said early, how the USOC people were harassing the other athletes, threatening them not to do anything, and, you know, it was a bad time.
Right. Were you in the stadium at the time, or?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. What was your initial reaction? Did you have any?
I didn't know it was going to happen.
Right.
But it resounded with me. I mean, I'd been, you know, outside of Detroit when the riots started. I'd seen the poverty in Mexico. I'd seen the lack of opportunity, you know, the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King. Everything was in an uproar.
Yes, ma'am.
And it was just finally in an internet. I mean, I can't say, you know, I wanted to believe in the whole idea of the Olympics as being non-political, but this was more than politics.
Sure.
This was at a human level that we knew things were changing in the world.
Yes, ma'am.
And in our country, and so, you know, it was powerful.
Right. Absolutely. Did you looking back at it now through the lens of time and everything else, do you feel it was appropriate, and do you think the IOC overreacted? Or
well, of course they did. They overreacted, and I think it was one of the bravest things I've ever seen anybody do.
Wow.
Yeah,
good. No, absolutely. What are your memories of the media at the time down there in Mexico City, did you?
Oh, yeah, the media was pretty much non-existent. You know, the favorites for gold medals, I think, were getting some you know, interest
right.
on the women's side. But overall, the only thing that was kind of negative on the airplane down, they were passing around Sports Illustrated, and in it was this picture of Kathy Rigby, the young gymnast, naked.
Oh,
was hidden behind many layers of kind of fuzzy veiling.
Yes,
and that was like the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue approach to women athletes.
Wow.
It was sickening, and it was disgusting, and, you know, it was just so inappropriate, and yet that was what the press wanted out of the women athletes.
Wow.
So that's about the only press I encountered.
Right, absolutely. Oh, goodness gracious. Did you stay around? Did you actually participate in the closing ceremonies?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And that was another interesting transition time, because the athletes, I mean, everybody was, you know, excited and thrilled that we'd been there, and it was just the ultimate, and everybody'd heard the closing was always so great, and then we all heard that we were being prevented from being part of it. We were to be in the stands and do nothing, and they were going to have a few representatives out there.
Uh-huh.
And so we had a few team leaders who were real rebels, I won't say who kind of orchestrated this. And there was an athlete section where we American athletes were sitting,
mm-hmm.
and closing went on, or just got started, and everybody kind of was we were all clued to do this. And there was like a moat, something like a moat between the edge of the stands and the track.
Uh-huh.
At the infield, and there were all these, we always call them the Boy Scouts. They were carrying pikes. They weren't pointed, but they were stiff.
Uh-huh.
They were all lined up, because I guess they'd heard we were going to be up to something. And we did. We just breached the gap. I mean, we just climbed over the rails, climbed over the Boy Scouts, and ran out on the field.
Right.
And that was, and interestingly enough, in the Olympic book,
mm-hmm.
they talk about the spectators going out on the field. What a lie that was. It was us.
Right.
And we started it. We American team started that, and it opened the floodgates. We ran around the track. It was joyful. It was wonderful. Everybody went quietly into the infield, and we proceeded with the closing, with everybody who wanted to be there was there.
Right.
And it was so much better. And they showed it at the Wide World of Sports for years after that. And that was us running around that track.
Right.
It was great.
Yeah, because you wanted to be part of the team for a last time.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I can understand, again, it was this attitude that we were meaningless in the scheme of things.
Wow.
Somehow, it was the old men of the IOC, it was their show, and we were, you know, it was a way of putting us out of the picture somehow. But it was wonderful. I mean, we had a great time. We weren't taking no for an answer, and and the ceremony was beautiful, and they even mentioned the sombreros. The Mexicans, they handed sombreros to everybody in the stadium.
Wow.
In the stands.
Yeah.
And so at one point, before they flashed the light, you know, in the big board showing Munich, which we could all look forward to.
Right.
There was they dimmed the lights, and everybody waved the sombreros.
Uh-huh.
And it was this swooshing sound of the wind. And then, you know, then the lights came on, and the Munich, big Munich lighted up. It was beautiful.
Oh, wow.
It was amazing. It was just an amazing moment. It was great.
That's great. Okay, so after the closing ceremonies, head back to Michigan? Or tell me about...
Yep, back to school.
Back to school.
To school.
Did you have to take out? Were you out that semester though, right?
Yes, I had withdrawn in the winter semester because I wanted to work and save money. I didn't have any money to go to the trials or anything at that point.
Right.
And so I worked I worked as a waitress and saved the money and the time too, where I could train.
Right.
And then of course it was late. We actually a group of us. A real international group, a plane load of crazy people after the Olympics went down to Santiago, Chile.
Oh, wow.
Immediately after the closing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was just kind of loosey-goosey, and what was left of their old Olympic committee, Chile was in a huge uproar, a huge problem going on down there, and they wanted to hang on and do something. And they got all these athletes. We had Germans, we had other South Americans, a ragtag group of Americans, Brits. I mean, it was just anybody who wanted to go. They put us on a plane, and we flew all the way down to the bottom of the world and had a meet down there, and it was kind of an interesting situation in itself if you want to hear about it. But
wow, that's awesome.
They were in the midst of a drought, a famine. It was, at the time, it was still Allende's government, and there were all kinds of issues going on. There were riots in the street. We stood on a balcony over the street, just one level up, and they were chasing people down the streets with water cannons.
Wow.
And then we had this, then we had the meet in the Olympic Stadium, and it was, it wasn't a very good experience, and that was the stadium where the missing finally, I mean, where, you know, in the movies and everything, they finally had all these people who had been killed when the rightist government came along later. But anyway, it was kind of a strange experience. So we did that, and we didn't have anything to eat except strange things. So we mostly ate bread for a week, and then we went home. So
When you went back to Michigan, do you think because of your experience that you were even more determined to get to Munich?
Absolutely. It was only the beginning. I wanted to be so much better.
Yes, ma'am. Great. What do you think your biggest motivator was for continuing to train and continuing to go on?
For
Munich, yeah. After
to be a real contender, to be absolutely really, really good. I wanted to be even better than I could imagine being at that stage. I wanted to be the best. I wanted to keep going. I just loved to compete and train. I loved to train. I mean, that was a huge part of my life. I didn't get to compete as much as I liked, but I loved to train. So
you
know, that's what I wanted to do, just be absolutely even better.
Sure.
Unknown quantities of improvement and moving up to the 1500 and, you know, all those things.
Which you didn't know that was in your plan at the time, right?
I think by then we knew there was a chance, but it still took a couple of years to really move into it, and then no opportunities to compete in it, but that's how it worked in this case. So.
Compare and contrast a little bit about the differences between Mexico City and Munich.
The same level of pride in their country, and of course Munich was determined to put a new face on the legacy of World War II. So, you know, it was the same level of pride and excitement and all of that. It was just a little more, you know, you didn't have the poverty, and you didn't have the issues that Mexico had faced, and nobody doubted the Germans would have. I don't think too many doubted, but I guess there are always doubters. But that Germany would put on a wonderful set of facilities and everything else.
Sure, you
know, which they did. So,
oh, absolutely, they did. Right. how do you think your life would have been different if Red didn't have found you and picked you out basically of kind of a very small crowd anyway?
I actually fear because of our lack of opportunity as women to really explore what we had the potential to do as careers and as people. We were still at the very beginning of any change, so career-wise, we weren't very, I know I didn't have much motivation. I didn't know what I would do with a college degree.
Right.
And the women were still graduating and getting jobs in a typing pool. It was very discouraging. So if I hadn't been able to keep running, I don't know what I would have done. Because I bought some time, let's put it that way. I bought some time, and by the time I finished at Munich, things had changed a lot. So I was glad I had that chance. I don't know what I could have done. I would have been very discouraged.
Yeah, did you retire from running after the Munich Games?
I tried to keep running for a couple of years. It wasn't easy. By then, it was time to make a living and move on.
Right.
Well, I did try to compete for a couple of years, but poverty was being a poor student in graduate school, and things like that intervened, and yet opportunity came along. So my first real job was as an athletic director for women at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, so I took that opportunity.
Wow.
And that's when I quit running. I mean, I still ran down Lake Michigan, Lakeside, to get to work.
Yes, ma'am.
I kept running for years and years and years, but those transition years, I still hoped to compete, but once I got, neck deep in coaching and being an administrator, that's when I finally hung up the spikes.
Sure.
So then, that was probably 1975, 76.
Wow.
So I was hoping to go a few more years, but didn't, so.
Well, you had a pretty good career after that, and still staying with athletics, which is a love and a calling all its own anyway. So,
oh, absolutely, and being able to coach and do those things was great. So
yes,
that
ma'am.
Opportunity finally presented itself.
What are your impressions about amateurism? Like you said, it was time to go get a job. Then it was really hard. Then it's a little easier now, but amateurism is a little different now for Olympians.
Well, now there's no such thing, and it didn't work. But on the other hand, if I had to say what I'd rather see,
yes, ma'am.
What I'd rather see is a complete sort of approach of support for post-collegians who, the collegiate, the high school and collegiate system, we need something kind of to prepare athletes for college,
yes,
need better high school training. But if you get through college, high school and college, then you need the post-collegiate experience. You need support. And I wish our country would come up with a way or through a better sponsorship system to support across the board. And as you imagine,
yes,
what happens is somebody like Tiger Woods gets all the money.
Yep.
Or Lance Armstrong, or somebody who happens to have a famous, they might not even be that good, but
right.
Oscar Pistorius is, an unusual story, but he wasn't even a star as far as being an athlete. But, he got tons of money thrown at him. So a few people get all the money, and unfortunately there's no across-the-board support for these post-collegians when they need it the most.
Sure. There's a few companies that do really well, and, of course, the U.S. military does really well in supporting athletes. But
but they support, but that's not across the board.
No, not at all.
These athletes come out of college, and they're already at international level, but they need the next step, and they don't get it.
Yes,
all the money, as I say, goes to one star that's picked out for whatever their reason. They might be great like Tiger Woods, or they might have, something else. But
yes,
one way or another, it's not enough. And it's been diminishing, not improving. I mean, that's been the case over the last decade or so. There's less money going to a broader stretch of athletes. They might get a pair of shoes free. They might get some uniforms. They're not getting much, to tell you the truth.
Yes, ma'am.
They might be national champions in college, but they're not getting enough to get them to the next level. So it's that's the way it is. But back in the old Soviet system, they were supported, and we were very envious of that because we were amateurs to the core. We couldn't get money for anything, and they were supported by the state. So, it was hard to beat that.
Right. What do you think the significance of the 1968 Olympic Games are? Do you think the 68 Games have impacted your life and others just because of the atmosphere that it was?
I think because the Olympics are, even today, are still such a focal point for the world, that the transition we were going through, particularly with civil rights, with the African nations emerging, with women emerging, it was really the epitome of what was happening around the world and in our country. So that it was very significant in illustrating what a movement really is, and the Olympic movement, can't be controlled. It's a movement in itself, and the people in it are what make it so important every 4 years or every 2 years when you count Winter Olympics, but especially the Summer Olympics, which are a focal point. And you know, it can be used in the wrong way, as it was in Munich, you know, with the terrorist attacks, but it can be so right for more people.
Yes.
That, you know, it continues to be that kind of focal point. But the things that were going on in 1968 were amazing, the changes that came out of those years.
I agree with you. What do you think about our little oral history project of the 68 Games?
Do you all are doing a wonderful thing to do it, because, you know, again, most of these groups and teams are not that well organized, and thanks to the leadership we've had from the 68 team, and then you as an academic study taking this on is really exceptional, and I appreciate what you're doing.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I do too. I relish the opportunity to actually talk, and I've done quite a few of these myself, and I'm just intrigued that we're capturing both, you know, orally, and then we'll have them transcribe the history itself, and from the people that are still around to speak of it. You know, before we lose the first hand.
Oh, I know, and you can lose it. It's not as if, you know, where you have wax cylinders and that's all we've got. We've got all this now. We can capture it, and it's great. Because we tried to do that with my coach before he died at 102, you know,
yes,
capture
ma'am.
His history, which was in itself fascinating. And you know, we never did get it all written down or captured, which I'm sorry we didn't do. But
right.
I'm glad you're doing it.
Absolutely. Me too. Is there anything else looking back that you don't think we covered, or anything else you want to share with anybody about the games?
I'm looking a little bit. I think that really is. I looked at all the potential topics and so on. I think we've covered most everything. I think in an hour and a half or whatever it's been. So.
Yes, ma'am. I think we're doing good. One last thing before I let you go. What would be your advice for Olympic hopefuls, especially women?
I could actually have that opportunity. That was one thought I had before this interview began. Just Saturday, my husband, who coaches at Eastern Michigan, they had a big alumni gathering and a banquet and different things, and one of last summer's Olympians from Eastern Michigan, I got to see him, and his name is Jamie Nieto. He was on the track team, and he is a nice young man, and they you know, made a special point of introducing him, and I said to him, I said, open your eyes wide, because he wants to go on. That's his plan, to
yes,
do
ma'am.
More, and I said the same thing that I had the opportunity to do. I said, open your eyes and ears and take it all in, experience it every moment that you have over the next 4 years, and especially if you go to the Olympics again. So, you know, that's the advice.
Great. That's outstanding. Do you have any questions for me or anything before we wrap this?
No, I imagine we're going to hear from you all when you put this all together. And
yes, ma'am.
Love to enjoy it at that point.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much, Francie. Thank you for all your recollections, and thank you for your time. You've been exceedingly generous with us.
Well, I don't mind at all, Steve, and I appreciate it, and I'm going to go out and get some groceries for the snow to come. But
outstanding. Yes, ma'am. Dress warm.
Yeah. Well, you take care.
Yes, ma'am. You too. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.